raids across the occupied West Bank as part of its intensified crackdown against Palestinians.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital of Tehran. This is Mias. Thanks for joining us.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the country will make the occupying Zionist regime regret its deadly airstrike on the Iranian consulate in the Syrian capital, Damascus. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei made the remarks in a message of condolence on the martyrdom of a group of Iranian military advisors in Monday's Israeli aerial raid on Syria. The leader described Israel as a hated occupying regime. He vowed that the evil regime will be punished. Ayatollah Khamenei also saluted the martyrs of the attack, including two senior IRGC commanders, Major General Mohammad Reza Zahedi and General Mohammad Hadi Haj Rahimi. Seven people have been confirmed killed in Israel's Monday's airstrike on the Iranian consulate in the Syrian capital, Damascus. According to Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the dead include two senior Iranian military personnel who were on an advisory mission to Syria, as well as five of their accompanying officers. Meanwhile, Iran's Supreme National Security Council held an emergency meeting after the Israeli attack on the consular section of the Iranian embassy. The council said appropriate decisions were taken over what it called another Israeli war crime against people enjoying diplomatic immunity. Tehran also called for a UN Security Council meeting on the Israeli aggression. According to Russia's UN envoy, the Security Council will hold an emergency meeting later on Tuesday to discuss the Israeli attack on Iran's consulate in Damascus. The attack has violated international law and the 1961 Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations.
In a blatant violation of international laws and human norms, the Israeli regime committed a heinous crime by attacking the consular services department of the Iranian embassy in Damascus. The attack destroyed a four-story building, killing several people. Iran's ambassador to Damascus said that the crime will not go unanswered.
You can see how all the glass and windows of my room were shattered as a result of the attack while I was present in my room at that time. Some journalists were in the upper floor and witnessed it with their own eyes. We were speaking with the minister and they documented what happened in my room. The Zionist entity does not respect anything at all, and Iran will respond decisively.
The attack was met with strong condemnations from several countries at the global and regional levels. The Syrian people and their leadership insisted that such attacks must be confronted with more resilience and support for the Palestinian people and resistance movements. They affirmed that these barbaric attacks would further strengthen the bond between the Syrian and Iranian people.
We expressed our condolences for the loss of life and our sorrow over these unjustifiable attacks targeting diplomatic institutions. We emphasized the necessity of maintaining Syrian-Iranian relations because they are built on ethics and values, unlike Western countries that support Israel in committing such crimes.
Observers believe that the attack is a violation of international law and humanitarian principles and is a result of the regime's military defeat in its genocidal war on Gaza. They say such crimes increases the determination of the region's peoples to achieve victory and expel this cancerous entity. Even the peoples of the world have come to realize the criminality and brutality of Israel.
This Israeli entity, which by Western standards is regarded as the oasis of democracy in West Asia, only knows the democracy of killing, crimes, destruction, targeting children, women, residential buildings, and violating international law. This was evident in the targeting of the diplomatic consulate building.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps says seven of its officers, two of whom were brigadier generals, were killed in the attack.
Today's aggression is further evidence of the savagery and disrespect for international law exhibited by this criminal entity. This regime's behavior underscores the need for a firm response by the international community. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi says the deadly Israeli airstrike on the country's consulate in Syria will not go unanswered. Raisi says Zionists should understand that they would never achieve their evil goals by carrying out such inhumane actions. He noted that the regime is desperate as it is witnessing the reinforcement of the resistance front on a daily basis. Raisi added that the hatred of free nations against Israel's illegitimate nature is also surging day by day. Earlier, the Iranian Foreign Ministry deplored Israel's aggression. It summoned the Swiss ambassador, which represents U.S. interests in Tehran. The foreign minister himself said that an important message was relayed to Washington as the main backer of the Israeli regime. Hossein Amir Abdullahian added that the U.S. must be held accountable for the Israeli crime. In a separate statement, the IRGC said the wolfish Zionist regime launched the airstrike on the Iranian consulate following its irreparable defeats to Palestinians in Gaza and resistance fighters in the region. Well, condemnations are pouring in following Israel's deadly airstrike on the Iranian consulate in the Syrian capital, Damascus. The Popular Resistance Committees, an umbrella group made up of several Palestinian factions, in a statement said the regime's crimes must not go unanswered. The Hamas resistance movement said, and the Islamic Jihad, also separately condemned the attack on the Iranian consulate. Lebanon's Hezbollah movement said that such crimes will result in more determination to resist and to confront the Israeli enemy. Yemen's Ansarullah movement denounced the Israeli attack as aggression on two brotherly countries. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine said that the attack would not force Iran to halt its support for Palestinian resistance. Several countries, including Iraq, Pakistan, Oman, Qatar, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, China, and Russia, also denounced the Israeli aggression as unacceptable. Political commentator Tim Anderson earlier joined us with his take on Israel's airstrike on the Iranian consulate in Syria.
It's not unique. There are a number of Iranian advisors who have been targeted and assassinated by the Israelis in recent months. And I think it's part of a concerted plan by the Netanyahu regime to try and provoke Iran. And it poses a dilemma because, of course, what the Israelis are looking for is an escalation which may help draw the US into a war, because, of course, the Israelis can't take on Iran by themselves. This is not the first provocation. There's a number of murders that have been carried out by the Israelis, and really, I think the anger amongst people around the world is really seething at the number of Palestinians they're killing, but also Syrians, Iranians, willy-nilly, the aid workers, journalists, you know. So I think this is a particular provocation aimed at Iran to try and get escalation. Really, the Israelis are unique in the region of wanting escalation because they're feeling more and more isolated.
An Israeli airstrike has left seven international aid workers associated with the U.S.-based charity World Central Kitchen dead in the Gaza Strip.
The WCK team was traveling in a deconflicted zone in two armored cars branded with the WCK logo and a soft-skin vehicle. Despite coordinating movements with the IDF, the convoy was hit as it was leaving the Deir al-Balah warehouse, where the team had unloaded more than 100 tons of humanitarian food aid brought to Gaza on the maritime route.
The head of the charity said she is, quote, heartbroken and appalled over the loss of her team in a targeted Israeli attack in Gaza. Aaron Gore called the airstrike unforgivable, saying the attack was not only on World Central Kitchen, but on humanitarian organizations showing up in the direst of situations where food is being used as a weapon of war. The organization also announced that it is halting all operations in the region. Meanwhile, the Hamas resistance movement slammed the attack, saying that the regime is pursuing its policy of systematic killings in order to terrorize aid workers and to disrupt humanitarian activities. Hamas also urged the international community to help put an end to Israeli crimes. Since the onset of the Israeli war on Gaza in early October, more than 32,900 Palestinians have been killed, most of them women and children. Let's get an update on this from Deir al-Balah. Muti Abu Musaba is our correspondent joining us. Muti, tell us more about this aid convoy that's U.S.-based, the circumstances of how it was targeted, and then for the people inside the convoy to have been assassinated, and of course other developments that are important coming out of the Gaza Strip.
Yes, Kavi, thank you. First of all, let me begin with the latest statement of Gaza's health ministry in terms of the Israeli atrocities committed over the last 24 hours against the Palestinian people here in Gaza Strip, whereas the Israeli forces committed at least 7 appalling massacres, claiming the lives of 71 Palestinian civilians, in addition to injuring roughly 130 others. These numbers actually took the whole number of the Palestinian civilians who have been killed since the beginning of this onslaught on Gaza Strip to roughly 32,920 Palestinian civilians. These numbers, as you can see, are rising incrementally with the continuous and ongoing Israeli attacks and incursions that are still hitting several areas of Gaza Strip. Over the last couple of hours, the Israeli warplanes destroyed a residential building in the eastern part of Deir el-Balah city, particularly in Abu al-Ajin town, which is located in the eastern part of Deir el-Balah city. As you know, two Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed as a result of that attack, in addition to dozens of the injuries. They were brought to the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital here, while in the northern part of the central area of Gaza Strip, a group of a number of the Israeli tanks actually raided Gaza Valley area, which is located in the northern part of the central area, between the central area and Gaza City, amid heavy gunfire and the continuous and chronic Israeli shelling towards the residential buildings in the Al-Nusarat refugee camp. The central area has been subjected to heavy and continuous attacks of the Israeli warplanes and the Israeli airstrikes and the Israeli artillery shelling for the last couple of months. That left dozens of the Palestinian casualties and inflicted more damage and destruction in the residential buildings and in the infrastructure. While when it comes to Khan Yunis city, the western part of Khan Yunis city, particularly the vicinity and the surrounding areas of the Nasser Medical Complex, witnessed more destruction as more residential buildings were blown up by the Israeli occupation forces in that area. Needless to mention that the entire area actually has been transformed to be just mound of debris over the ceaseless Israeli attacks. There are many rising concerns and fears among the people there that the same scenario that took place in the Ashifa Medical Complex would be reiterated and repeated in that area, in the surrounding areas of the Nasser Medical Complex, while the eastern parts of Khan Yunis witnessed also another Israeli airstrikes and attacks against the residential buildings there. When it comes to Rafah city, the number of the Palestinian civilians who were killed over the last attack that took place during the last night amounted to 10 Palestinian civilians, including five Palestinian children, after they were attacked while they were sleeping inside their house. The Israeli occupation forces destroyed their house over their heads. In the meantime, another attack took place over the last couple of hours against another residential building in that area, claiming the lives of 3 Palestinian civilians. So the Israeli incessant attacks are still continued and maintained against all areas of Gaza Strip, claiming more lives of the Palestinian civilians. On the other hand, when it comes to the horrendous crime the Israeli occupation forces committed against the aid workers in Deir el-Balah city, as you know that those workers were working for the International and the World Kitchen, actually, and they were helping the people. They were alleviating the suffering of the Palestinian people. They brought a group of the humanitarian aid in order to be delivered to the people. And as you have mentioned in the report, that they are coordinating their movements on the ground with the IOF side, with the Israeli occupation forces, and they are moving using their cars, which are marked with the slogans of their organization. However, the Israeli occupation forces deliberately attacked them. According to the people, this crime actually comes in the context of the continuous and the systematic Israeli attacks against everything about the humanitarian conditions here in Gaza Strip. As you know that at the beginning, the Israeli occupation forces targeted the UNRWA and the distribution centers belong to the agency. Different and multiple distribution centers were attacked and destroyed. After that, they targeted the police officers and the policemen and members who were working on the ground in order to secure and to guarantee the fair distribution of this humanitarian aid to the needy people, particularly in Gaza City and the northern part of Gaza Strip. Hundreds of the Palestinian police officers and members were killed by the Israeli continuous attacks.
Thank you so much for that, Muti. We appreciate it. Muti Abu Musabad there from Darabala. Thank you. Palestinians in the West Bank have been enduring intensified raids by Israel since the onset of the regime's war in Gaza. Israeli occupation forces have carried out fresh raids on towns, villages, and refugee camps across the occupied territories. The regime has stormed homes, made multiple arrests, wounding a number of Palestinians during these raids. The correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us earlier with more updates. Let's take a listen.
The Israeli troops stormed several villages, East Qalqilia as well as South Qalqilia, like Jayus, Azun, and Habli, as well as Asli village. During the incursions to these villages, the Israeli troops stormed the Palestinians' homes, confiscated belongings, caused damage within the houses, and arrested a number of Palestinians. The Israeli troops had also stormed several areas around Al-Quds, like the refugee camp of Qalandia, for several hours. Exchange of fire have taken place between the Israeli forces and the residents of the refugee camp. The troops stormed the home of Mohammed Manasra, martyr Mohammed Manasra. He carried out an anti-Israeli operation in near the settlement of Aili, and he was shot and killed. Today, again, the Israeli forces stormed his home during this operation, and during the exchange of fire, a number of Palestinians had been wounded by the Israeli forces. At least seven Palestinians were arrested from Qalandia, a refugee camp. The Israeli troops in southern the occupied West Bank raided several towns in Al-Khalil area, raided the town of Beit Umar, and arrested at least one Palestinian, according to reports coming from Beit Umar. 14-year-old Palestinian was arrested by the Israeli forces. During the military raid to Qalandia refugee camp, the Israeli forces stormed Palestinians' homes and gathered dozens of Palestinian youths inside the refugee camp, interrogated them and questioned them.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In this episode, we want to present to you an extract from the speech of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, about Imam Ali alayhi salam. The commander of the faithful words and addresses, full of enthusiasm and full of wisdom, have provided instructive lessons for all humans to live by to this day. And these are all signs of his strengths. His robust physique, intellect, determination, management, and style of rhetoric were all indications of a strong and powerful individual. At the same time, this strong man was wrong. Signs of oppression against him could be witnessed in the behavior of his enemies and the envious. They could be witnessed in the unfair accusations that were leveled against him by the agents of his enemies during his lifetime and in the materialistic behavior of some of his companions. A number of his companions and comrades broke away from him because they pursued their materialistic desires. These are hints of oppression against that great personality. The burdens that were exerted on him from various sides were so vast that this patient, ocean-like heart of a man was so tolerant that he is said to have complained into a well. He would open up into a well. These instances are all indications of the persecution faced by the commander of the faithful.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
After his demise and martyrdom, his enemies, who had seized the government, would insult him for many years at their podiums. They would insult him throughout that vast country. They would speak harshly of the commander of the faithful, who was the embodiment of piety, justice, and fair-mindedness. Coincidentally, when we take a general look at those events, we see in that prolonged battle, the commander of the faithful was the final victor. Today, notice where the commander of the faithful's name and personality stands in this vast human panorama and history. He stands at the peak, and there is no trace of his enemies. His natural balagha, which was compiled by Sayyid al-Razi, one of the Shiite scholars, is an instructive lesson for heightened individuals. His tradition is the most important and prominent tradition after that of the Holy Prophet of Islam. His form of justice and his great personality were outstanding features in this day and age. His cause defeated that of his enemies. He was the final victor.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you.
Cancer, the new trailblazers.
One of the oldest and most widespread diseases in the world, cancer has always existed and is found in all living things, including plants. It was once thought to be related to the humours, to be contagious or viral in origin. Today it is believed that the cause may be genetic. In every age, new weapons have been unsheathed against cancer, but none have succeeded in vanquishing it. And yet scientists now are able to decipher some of its most intricate processes. Could these advances have been misleading? Could they have in fact led the scientific community astray?
It now appears very likely that we got lost in the details. Our focus was wrong. We were looking at the details of the engine in the car when that wasn't really the problem.
We tend to research the details without seeing the big picture. We lose the forest for the trees.
Einstein said, for an idea that people don't think is crazy in the beginning, there is no hope.
The time has come in America when the same kind of concentrated effort that split the atom and took man to the moon should be turned toward conquering this dread disease.
It's now been over 40 years since the war against cancer was declared by one government or another.
La lutte contre le cancer s'est fixée comme objectif.
70% of the cancers that were fatal in the 1950s can now be cured. But such undeniable achievements are, in the end, relatively minimal. In spite of the many billions that have been invested in cancer research in the last half century, mortality rates have not decreased as much as expected. The disease continues to kill 8 million people every year. But how well do we really know this enemy? And to begin with, how do we define it?
When certain cells start to go out of control, which is the case with cancer, they are no longer following their genetic programming. What happens in this process, which is called mutation, is that the cells change their own DNA. So the DNA is altered, the control mechanism is impaired, and as a result, they escape genetic regulation. That's what is now called the genetic theory or the mutational theory of cancer, which states that cancer is caused by mutations that occur in cancer cells.
I do think that there is by now a commitment to genetics. There is a commitment in our National Institutes of Health. How could there not be? Our director is a geneticist.
Today, we have dozens of countries across the world really involved in the race to actually sequence cancer genomes, find cancer genomes. So the science of cancer is really progressed very quickly because we now understand genetics and genomes and we can actually catalog mutations.
When I was studying the rise of oncogene research, it was a new bright star, right? It was a hope. People really thought that we were getting to the basic causes of cancer, and that it would eventually lead to solutions, to treatments.
Drugs such as Gleevec and Herceptin have without question contributed to advances in the treatment of certain leukemias and breast cancers. But for almost all of the other cancers, the results have been disappointing.
It means that we would become caught up in a never-ending chain of events without ever really arriving at a cure. That, I think, is one of the limitations of targeted therapies.
The major challenge that we have is to understanding what the data means. I was part of the Human Genome Project during the 1990s, and we sequenced that whole genome. It took 10 years, and we still don't understand most of the genes and the proteins and what the genomes do. So we still, our ability to do an interpretation of one genome, a whole community of scientists across the world is still challenged. It's how difficult it is.
In the early 1990s, patient advocacy groups were formed in protest against this fixation on genetics. They criticized its lack of therapeutic results. The organization Breast Cancer Action was founded in San Francisco in order to get cancer research out of its rut by challenging, first of all, its dogmatic focus on genetics. Yes, inherited gene mutations may increase the risk of cancer, but only in 5 to 10% of the cases.
Inheriting a gene does not mean that you will get breast cancer. And we really do have to look at the inherited gene and environment interactions and why for some people it leads to cancer and for some people it doesn't.
When you take these cells from the person and put it in a dish, or from an animal and put it in the dish, the genes are not fixed. They are regulated by context. They are regulated by microenvironment. So that just clarified a lot of things for me, that, again, context or microenvironment And in this case, the architecture of the tissue was very, very important. And once you destroyed the architecture, that in combination with the oncogene could make a tumor.
In a forest, if there's a plant or an animal species that proliferates to the point of destroying the ecosystem, that is literally the equivalent of cancer in the body. Rather than seeing the body as something that functions under the centralized control of our DNA, if we see it as a self-regulating system, like a forest or an ocean, we will then start to look at how the element that is proliferating gets access to nutritional resources and will study the predators. So, for example, if a certain type of rabbit suddenly begins to multiply to the point of destroying the forest, we're not going to say, oh, the rabbit has mutated. We would wonder instead if carrots hadn't become more abundant for some reason, or if some of the other species that would normally compete with the rabbits hadn't disappeared. Or whether the foxes that kept a check on the rabbit population hadn't some kind of problem that year. And so all of a sudden, instead of looking for mutations, you're faced with a more global vision of balances and imbalances.
Cancer specialist Laurent Schwartz also supports a more global vision of the cancer process. If we want to better understand how a cancer cell thrives, we have to study its resources and how it uses them. That is what we call metabolism.
A cell is a living organism. If you take a small human cell, remove it and put it in the right environment, one that provides it with water, blood, and whatever it needs, it will grow. It'll take in food, digest it, and continue to survive, and it will use genes, enzymes, and so forth in order to do so. It's the same with a cancer cell. It takes in food, it grows, and it uses enzymes. It's clear that in order to divide, a cell has to grow. It may be stating the obvious, but if you don't eat, you won't grow. And if you burn everything off when you're out jogging in the morning, you'll never get fat. So if you want to get fat, you have to take in food and not burn it off. And that takes us back to the hypotheses of the 1920s, which show quite simply that cancer feeds on glucose, in other words, on sugar, in massive quantities that it cannot burn, and so it grows. And when it grows, the cells divide, and when they divide, they become hard. As every clinician knows, cancer is hard to the touch. And then, when it's under pressure, metastatic cells will start to break off.
This theory of cancer based on cell metabolism has already been postulated back in the 1920s by the German biologist and Nobel laureate Otto Warburg. Otto Warburg believed that metabolism plays a key role in the development of cancer. It is concerned with the way in which our cells feed, the way in which they do or do not digest the sugar, fat, and proteins they absorb. A normal cell takes in, for example, glucose, which is broken down during a first phase and then converted by the mitochondria, which are like the lungs of the cell. In order to do this, oxygen is used. If everything is functioning normally, nutrients are burnt and converted into energy. A cancer cell, however, behaves as if it were deprived of oxygen. Without oxygen, it is unable to burn the glucose, and so very little energy is produced. To compensate for this, it consumes huge amounts of glucose, which is still unable to digest, and this, in turn, leads to a process of fermentation and continuous cell division. This is what is called the Warburg effect. Otto Warburg was awarded the Nobel Prize for his work, but his theories subsequently fell into oblivion. During the war, he was protected by Hitler, who had a well-known phobia of cancer, and so, for historical reasons, he was made to pay for his pact with the devil. And then the rise of genetics, which dominated the research and drained all the funds, took care of the rest. In the last 10 years, however, there's been renewed interest in Otto Warburg's theories. Cancer cells and their metabolism are once again being investigated around the world. In January 2014, a conference on metabolism was held in Luxembourg for the first time ever in Europe. Scientists from around the world came to discuss their work, galvanized by this exciting new possibility for cancer research. Many of them now believe metabolism to be the Achilles heel of cancer cells for any type of cancer.
People like me have argued, instead of looking at all of these changes all the time, the genetic changes and all this bioinformatic analysis and the constant need to sequence, as maybe we should just step back and look at some other ways to think about cancer. We had plenty of in vitro data that if you disrupted...
The American researcher Navdeep Chandal first became interested in metabolism while he was a student back in the late 1990s. He felt it was a subject that deserved much more attention than it was getting at a time when everyone else was focusing on genetics.
So in other words, cancer metabolism is an alternative because now you're not looking at genes, you're looking at metabolic pathways. And by the way, we know those pathways. We've known those pathways for 50 years. So now you don't have to go in and rediscover anything new. I mean, there is some new pathways still yet to be discovered, some small new pathways. But generally, that encyclopedia of pathways is there. And now we just have to go back and look at those pathways, how they're being rewired in cancer. Because those pathways make much better targets than anything in the nucleus, I would argue. That's a biased opinion.
If genetic mutations are not the primary, but rather the secondary agents of cancer, then what causes the disease? And in order to fight it or prevent it, where should we focus our efforts? What kinds of strategies should we employ?
Obesity is the worst risk factor for cancer. One of the things I say to people, I say reduce the sugar intake. Sugar intake, metabolism, works in conjunction with a whole lot of other things, and it works in conjunction with obesity. And the worst thing that, for example, has happened in US, there is this huge amount of obesity because people eat, their food is not what our body needs. So, in fact, we could reduce the amount of cancer in the world by a huge amount if people would have more fiber, less sugar, less bad fat.
So is cancer just a question of diet? That would be too simple. To begin with, the foods we eat are not the only things that nourish our cells. There are other factors involved in cellular metabolism.
For adult cancers, you very often have an inflammatory stage. For example, alcoholism will give you hepatitis, an enlarged liver, cirrhosis, and then liver cancer. For a chronic smoker, you'd get chronic bronchitis, coughing, and then lung cancer. So we find this sequence almost all of the time: inflammation, fibrosis, cancer. Inflammation is a change in metabolism that occurs when a cell is confronted with a violent and massive absorption of food. The cell doesn't take it very well, and very often when it happens, some of the cells will die. The cells that survive find themselves gorged with food, and they will change their behavior and start to proliferate.
Metabolism is a great sensor in changes. It can detect changes in diet, environment, and even some like your habits. So if you have the same sort of genes that you've had for 10,000 years, and what's changing is diet, environment, and habits, the first thing that's going to sense those changes in diet or your environment or in your habits even is metabolism, which then feeds onto the genes, and then the genes drive the disease. That's the new paradigm.
A new paradigm also means new therapies. In what ways can we act on the metabolism of cancer cells? How can we stop them from proliferating? What treatments can be used?
There are various ways of changing tumor metabolism, of improving it. You can do it through your diet, in other words, by reducing the amount of glucose that you consume, and by reducing the amount of food that you eat in general. That's one possibility. However, it hasn't really been tested. Many people do it, but to be honest, we have very few of the proper, clear-cut kind of studies that scientists are so fond of. Another way is to work with the kinds of drugs that specifically target those circuits. That's the approach we've chosen because it's easier to study.
Professor Navdeep Chandal is convinced that certain agents that already exist, that are already being prescribed for other ailments, could also be effective for treating cancer. In fact, there are already an estimated 100 drugs that could be used due to their action on the cellular breakdown of glucose.
In the last 15 years plus, the epidemiologists, just looking at records, noticed that people who were on metformin had lower incidence of cancer. And so that prompted people in the laboratory to test metformin as an anti-cancer agent in mice. And they found, in fact, we use it in the laboratory as our model for cancer, that a variety of different cancers, colon cancer, lung cancer, pancreatic cancer, if you gave mice metformin, you had lower cancer. So that was good.
Metformin is an anti-diabetic drug that has been on the market since the late 1960s. How could it contribute to combating cancer? Its primary action is to inhibit glucose production by the liver. And we know that cancer cells are avid consumers of glucose. Metformin would thus be able to cut off their food supply, which would in turn prevent the diseased cells from proliferating.
We did it in 10 mice, and metformin decreased tumor burden by 75%. Obviously, it's not meaningless. It can slow the progression down. Maybe you don't cure it, right? But it can increase the longevity.
There are limitations, though, of the work done in petri dishes and in animals. And in relation to metformin, one of the major concerns is that much of the work has used metformin in concentrations that are unsafe in humans. So it's very difficult to translate much of that work into the clinical setting.
And yet, the Canadian researcher Pamela Goodwin has decided to take up the challenge. She's currently overseeing a clinical trial being carried out in Canada, the United States, and Switzerland. It involved 3,600 breast cancer patients who have since 2013 been taking 2 metformin pills per day in addition to their standard treatment. The results will be evaluated in 2017.
The goal of this study is to see whether adding metformin to standard treatment of breast cancer will improve the survival of women with breast cancer.
Every year, over 1 million women around the world are diagnosed with breast cancer, and nearly half of them will die from the disease. Yet testing an old medication like metformin, which might prove to be effective, was an uphill battle. It took 10 years for Pamela Goodwin to obtain the funds needed for this study.
When scientists like myself and others that are interested in metformin want to develop an available drug as a cancer treatment, it's very difficult. Many other scientists that are looking at other agents have faced challenges and haven't been able to do the definitive studies. And I think we as a society have to address this issue. If metformin proves to be effective in breast cancer, we estimate that first it will cost about $200 a patient for the entire 5 years of study. That is very inexpensive compared to the $50,000, $75,000, $100,000 that it costs for some of the new biologic treatments. But more importantly, it's a drug that can be used around the world. It's low cost and low toxicity, and it's oral. It's a pill. For better or for worse, much of the drug development research that's done in cancer is done by pharmaceutical companies. And these companies are making major contributions to cancer. But they're focusing on drugs that have come through their pipelines for which they want to make a profit.
Several giants in the pharmaceutical industry, sensing the potential for a new market, are now working to develop metabolic treatments for cancer.
When we started the company in 2002, and again, it was based on targeting this unique metabolic properties of cancer cells, We were probably one of maybe 20 or 40 people that we spoke with who were even aware of Otto Warburg. And occasionally we would meet with potential investors who were older, guys in their 60s and 70s, who when we described what we were doing, they would say, oh, you're targeting the Warburg effect.
In the United States, certain companies are already entirely devoted to the metabolic approach. Among them, Threshold Pharmaceuticals, based in South San Francisco, California.
The idea is that if you can develop an effective therapy that really targets the Warburg effect, you may have a much broader therapeutic that would treat a much wider variety of cancers than would be the case with these molecularly targeted approaches.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the holy prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant fact.
Imamat yek asle zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. Please stay tuned. When Prophet Muhammad finished his sermon about the months of Ramadan, Imam Ali alayhi salam stood up among the audience and asked, O Prophet of Allah, which deed is the best one in this holy month? Prophet Muhammad answered, observing piety or taqwa. Piety or taqwa means that during the holy month of Ramadan, we are not only hungry and thirsty, but also all our body organs are fasting too. After finishing his answer, Prophet Muhammad started shedding tears. The audience asked Prophet Muhammad about the reason for his shedding tears. Prophet Muhammad answered, Ali, who asked this question, will be martyred during this holy month. Upon hearing this answer, Imam Ali alayhi salam never asked about the place, the exact time, and the killer, but he asked, O Prophet of Allah, at the time of my martyrdom, am I among the faithful believers of Islam or not? This question of Imam Ali alayhi salam means that he was only and only concerned about his destiny and fate as a true Muslim, and this is very important. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. To find out more about this program, please log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. One of the biggest responsibilities that Muslims have been endowed with has been to propagate Islam and spread awareness about the causes that are most important to the Muslims. It's also amplified by the fact that the world is under the spell of the Zionist-owned and controlled media empire, which is uniquely hostile to Muslims and Islam, evidenced by their shameful coverage of the genocide in Gaza and other issues related to Islam. In this week's episode, we will explore what the responsibilities of Muslims are in propagating the religion, defending the Muslims and Islam with the tongue, and clarifying the falsehoods of the global media. First, we take a look at what the religion of Islam says about these matters in the holy texts of the religion.
The religion of Islam is, and has been from its conception, a fast-growing religion. One of the reasons for that has been the focus on propagating the religion or performing da'wah, literally calling others to the straight path. It is also a religion that calls on its followers to correct misconceptions and falsehoods, as well as enjoying the good and forbidding the evil. First, we can go to the Holy Quran to learn what Islam says about propagating the religion to others. In Surah 41, Ayah 33, Allah Ta'ala says, "Who is better in speech than one who calls to Allah, does righteous deeds, and says, 'Indeed, I am amongst the Muslims.'" In Surah 16, Ayah 125, Allah also says, "Call to the way of your Lord with wisdom and good preaching." Thus, it is a direct command from God that believers must propagate the religion of Islam, wherever they are, and must do so with the best of manners and etiquette. Allah Ta'ala also instructs the believers to enjoin the good and forbid the evil. You are the best nation raised up for humankind. You enjoin righteousness, forbid corruption, and you believe in Allah. This concept of calling others to the right path and calling out wrong behavior or ideas is also found in a famous hadith of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, who says, "Whoever of you sees wrong being committed, let him rectify it with his hand. If he is unable, then with his tongue, and if he is unable, then with his heart." And this is the weakest of faith. And this is a theme which has been explored in a recent book released by the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, entitled Jihad al-Tabiyin. This means the struggle against misconceptions, which, as he points out, is even more important a duty on Muslims in an age where social media and the mainstream media spread such damaging lies about Muslims, as well as others who find themselves in the firing line of the global Zionism and its Western government puppets.
To discuss this important topic are two very special guests. We're honoured to welcome Dr. Reza John Vadadi, who is a multiple award-winning filmmaker based in London. Over the past 12 years, Dr. Vadadi has directed, produced and filmed over 50 documentaries that delve into the West Asian Muslim identity and culture, and he has also presented academic papers at numerous institutions across the world. Also joining us is the esteemed Sister Sahar Jaber. Sahar has an honours degree in Sociology and Communication Studies from McMaster University. She resides in Lebanon, where she studies at the Islamic Seminary. She co-founded Figs and Olives Publications, an Islamic publishing house aiming to provide reliable and impactful resources for parents, institutions and children in English. Assalamu alaikum to you both. Thank you for joining us on the show. Sister Jaber, if I could begin with you. We just saw in the video at the top of the show some of the verses that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has revealed for the Muslims to understand their duties in propagating the religion of Islam. What are your thoughts, first of all, on some of those verses that Allah has revealed?
I think those verses stress on the idea, in fact, that the prophets themselves, their main role in this world was to propagate Islam. That's the very essence and the purpose of a prophet himself. And so what Allah does is he does not stop at the prophet. It is not possible that the prophet was the last one to propagate Islam and then we should continue in our ways. What Allah asks from us is for us ourselves to propagate Islam. إِنِّي جَعَلٍ فِي الْأَرْضِ خَلِيفًا بِسْمِ اللَّهِ الرَّحْمَنِ. And so understanding this verse is that we have a responsibility in ourselves to be a representation for Allah, to be a representation on this earth in the way of God. A lot of individuals in this day and age, especially because of the society we're in, the feminine society we're in, they're very afraid to put on their beliefs or what they actually think would be true to others because they don't want to enforce anything. They don't want to enforce any religion. But Islam itself says you need to propagate in the way of your actions, propagate Islam, because that's the very essence of your purpose. What's to be a khalifa? What's to be a representation of God?
Absolutely. And there was another a hadith actually that we touched upon in that video, which is the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam saying that Muslims, if they see a wrong, they should correct it by their hand if they can, and if not by their tongue, and if not then at least oppose it in their hearts, which of course is the lowest form of belief. What do you think are the duties of Muslims when it comes to enjoining the good and forbidding the evil?
When we talk about forbidding the evil and enjoining the good, the reason why there's different levels is because if you can do it by tongue, it's the best, of course, to speak. But however, we know in this day and age, sometimes someone cannot accept and maybe even they will put some force on you in a way in which is unacceptable. And so at that manner, enjoining good and forbidding evil will even go towards your eyesight. And so in a way in which you do not show them that you are smiling or that you excel or accept what they're saying. Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq even says, call the people towards Islam without using your tongue, to the point in which your very representation in the workforce, in the community, it's a representation of what it means to be a Muslim. And in force, people are then questioning about Islam. We see, for instance, in Gaza right now what's happening. So many are converting to Islam because they are seeing, not by words, not by the tongue, but by the actions, what it means to be a Muslim, and they are being introduced to it in a beautiful way.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Vadadi as well, I would maybe pick up the same point with yourself. Anything to add on that?
I think also one thing I always thought about is those people who are Muslim, from the Muslim Ummah, from the Muslim community, and they don't have the connection to what we're discussing in the sense that sometimes they accept injustice. I think sometimes we have to remember that injustice starts in the heart, and so we need to reevaluate. That's why it goes, if you can't do it by tongue, by hand, by tongue, then the heart, because it initiates in the heart. If your heart is not purely against oppression, doesn't matter what your tongue says, it emanates from the heart. So that's why it's important that we go back to the root, being the heart. And those who are not emanating against oppression, they need to reevaluate their connection with Islam and Allah, that something is not correct in their heart.
And if I can say with you, Doctor, you know, you're a media professional, you're somebody who has vast experience over decades